I'm Les Norford. I teach in the School of Architecture at MIT. I'm a mechanical engineer by training. This is a session on energy and buildings, and my co-speaker is Alexis Karalidis from Rocky Mountain Institute. She's trained as an architect, practices as an architect in a kind of a green consulting practice. So we have complementary skills and hopefully a complementary message to share with you. So like some of the other tutorials, it'll be a kind of a tag team PowerPoint. We'll try to exercise enough discipline to leave a reasonable amount of time for discussion. If there's anything that seems particularly, you know, vexing during the talk, just feel free to interrupt. We don't have to wait until the end. I want to give you a little bit of background. Some of it you've heard if you've been in the energy sessions. Some thoughts on residential buildings, some commercial buildings, a little bit of buildings in other countries, particularly China and India, and then maybe a little assessment of what we have. Many of you have seen plots like this in the last couple of days. Our global energy consumption is the top line, our 14 terawatt global economy. The U.S. is the magenta. I don't have a pointer here, but we can stand. North America as well. Asia, including China and India, has grown a lot over the last 25 years, gone about 2.5 times. Eastern Europe down, but Africa, Asia, oh, great, thank you very much. Africa, South America, very, very low, and increasingly a smaller part of the world pie. I find it useful to look at this on a per capita basis, and this is just done from the largest to the smallest. Now, Gibraltar has very few people in it. The U.S. is here, about 11 kilowatts a person. That's our share of global energy use. The world average is about 2. China, a little more than 1, and India, a little less than a half. So. Part of the message here in terms of buildings is that there's ample room to for progress in the U.S. and other developing countries. Something I learned a long time ago when I was a grad student under Rob Soklow, who's here from Princeton, was to look at how energy use correlates with quality of life. And this is a generation old, but it hasn't changed much. And so here's the KW per capita, and it only goes up to 2 on this scale. Quality of life is a weighted average of life expectancy, infant mortality, and literacy. And the point here is that once you get up above 1 or so, and certainly by the time you're at 2, the current global average, there's not a lot to be gained. We have a very affluent lifestyle, but in terms of meeting the needs of the world's poor and meeting our fundamental needs, the U.S. out here at you know 10 or 11, way off the scale someplace, we're using more than we need for on that sort of metric. Okay, so for the U.S., a quarter of the world's energy consumption, how does that split up? We want to get into buildings here. For total energy use, buildings are about 40%, pretty much even between residential and commercial. Transport and industry, a little less than 30%, a little more. If we look at electricity, buildings in the U.S. account for about 70% of the country's electricity consumption. So it's a significant chunk of our economy. Going back over the last 20 years, 25 years, there's not been a whole lot of change over time. Residential on the top, commercial down here. The magenta are end use, what you pay for your at the meter, pay to your utility companies, and the darker color above are so-called primary energy use, which accounts primarily for the inefficiencies associated with producing and transporting electricity. That's particularly noticeable in commercial buildings, which are increasingly electrified. One number to remember here, the U.S. average for commercial buildings is about 300 kilowatt hours a square meter a year. And we'll kind of use that as a metric for some low energy buildings a little bit later. Okay. So where does this energy go? For houses, it's primarily heat. This is a national average. Water heating, lighting, still significant, even though many more of us are using air conditioning, and certainly in some parts of the country, it's only about 11% of the total. everything here is pretty much understandable. This SEDS is just an adjustment to different sources of energy data. For commercial buildings, not as much need for heat, primarily because we're generating so much heat from bodies and equipment. So lighting is the largest single piece. It's about a quarter of the total. Heat and cooling, pretty comparable, and then on down from there. So if we want to make a difference in houses, heat is probably the number one target, and in commercial buildings, lighting deserves a lot of attention. Okay, so let's look at houses for a couple minutes, and here's one form of a punchline before we get to the details. It is possible in the United States to save about 30% of whole building energy use at little or no increase in first cost. And these are new buildings. A fair amount of this you can do in existing buildings, cost effectively. You can save about 50% of whole building energy at little or no increase in life cycle cost. So if you're willing to amortize an investment over the life of the improvement, be it windows or furnaces, to get to something that's carbon neutral or say net zero energy, that's harder. I'll show you some examples. The cost of PV is an issue in that. The big message here, maybe the overall theme in what I'll say throughout, is to do this through an integrated or kind of systems level thinking. Amory Lovins, who talked about transportation yesterday, has talked about this at some length in buildings, those of you who have heard him on that subject. The issue here is to trade off what you do to the building shell, on the insulation, the air tightness, the windows, against smaller heating and cooling plant. So you not only end up with lower operating costs, but lower first costs. You're buying a smaller chiller, a smaller boiler, because you're putting more up front into the walls and the windows. Okay, here's a little passive solar village, sort of student style, where I teach. These are little houses that people make. We put in temperature loggers. We see how they work over a week or two, entirely passive. We're trying to keep the hypothetical occupant, we call these things elf houses, at about 20 degrees C, sort of comfortable temperatures, 70 Fahrenheit or so, regardless of outside temperatures, and we do it at a time of year where it's about freezing, 0 degrees C. So they're trying to get 20 degrees of boost. How? A lot of insulation. You can see the kind of pink board you buy from Home Depot, some south-facing glass, and then a means of storing some energy. You see some water bottles there, like our little Fiji bottles here, to moderate the temperature so it doesn't overheat in the day and get too cold at night. Here's an example of how that works, and it doesn't show outside, but outside's pretty close to zero. So before and after some improvements, these are spiking up pretty high. 40 is 104 Fahrenheit, so you wouldn't be too comfortable in that. But with a little more attention to insulation and mass, then the swings get down, and the average temperature is pretty good relative to outside. So how does that scale up to something we might think of living in? Here's Thoreau's house, a historical view of what's since been rebuilt at Walden. If Henry David were to come back today and make that out of 6 inches of the extruded polystyrene, the pink board or blue board insulation, and neglected windows, and I'm just going to build myself a little bunker, he would need, in the dead of a Boston winter, say coldest day when it's about zero Fahrenheit, about 1,000 watts to keep himself comfortable at, say, 70 Fahrenheit, okay? And his body heats maybe a tenth of that. So he's going to have to do something else, a hairdryer equivalent. Now, he also needs to breathe, unlike my little student projects, and that costs something, too. That's about another 500 watts to heat the air that would have to come in to take care of his CO2, all right? So 1,500 watts total. Now, if he were really clever in today's era, he could recover some of the heat from that air, but we'll touch on that a little later, okay? Henry David had windows. We can do windows, too. So if we scale up those things you saw on the roof a few slides ago, took Thoreau's house, put about 5 meters, that's about a third of the south-facing facade, just plain old double-pane clear glass, nothing fancy, okay, and stuffed in about 1,000 kilograms of water, which is about 2,000 of these, okay, so more or less line the walls and the floor to keep it from overheating during the day and getting too cold at night, then what you end up with is something that looks like this, where outside The low here is it's just about 0 Fahrenheit, so this is sort of a design day in Boston. And inside, it's averaging about 20. It goes up to upper 20s, so that's upper 70s, and down in the 50s at night. Not so bad, okay? Entirely passive, and he can live in this house. No heating system at all in a Boston winter. All right? Now, can we do this on a larger scale? Are we doing it on a larger scale? Yes, the Department of Energy for the last 10 years or so has had a program called Building America that aspires to do something very similar. There are 33,000 houses in this country that have undergone some amount of this. Kind of a list of the usual goals here: energy efficiency, reduced cost, comfort, health, durability. I want to get back to that. The target here is not 100% passive, but it is 35 to 45% reduction in heating, cooling, and hot water costs. And again, at a cost-effective investment. Okay. So that comes from envelope. We've seen some of that, a lot of insulation, a lot of care to keeping out leaks, ceiling houses, being careful about penetrations through your outside walls, and a lot from windows. Investments in windows, you all have some sense that if you go from, say, cooling energy, this is in Phoenix, you can go from $600-some a year for cooling cost to $400 as a function of using better windows, windows that will slow down the rate at which the sun comes through them. This comes through low-E coating, a coating that will reduce the radiative heat transfer from the window. For heating, where I am, the same sort of choice on windows can reduce your heating costs by on the order of 40%. Okay. And it's these savings and the savings in smaller plant that pays for the windows. Now, windows, one way to look at them is we get visible light, which we use for views, and we also get heat. The combined full spectrum, about half of that is visible. The other half is in the infrared. If you go from, say, single pane to double pane glass, both of those get lopped down proportionally. Single pane glass, you're getting about 90% of both. If you go to a low emissivity coating, which is what you get if you, say, get a Marvin Anderson or Pella window, you're getting 65 to 75% of both. You can now get windows where you keep the visible, but you knock out the sun, spectrally selective windows. So for those of you living in hot climates, you can keep your gorgeous view and reduce your cooling loads at the same time. You can tune these depending on orientation, where south you may want to knock out the sun, north and east, you may want to keep it for morning heat. Okay. Are builders interested in doing this? Well, it's a very diffuse market, as you know, but some builders have been happy to participate in this. Durability is the key here, and that mainly comes from controlling moisture through envelopes, which reduces mold and mildew issues, callbacks, lawsuits, and that sort of thing. On the downside, they have to learn some new construction techniques, framing systems, and building codes in some cases have to change. Here's some examples of these houses. They don't look like my little styrofoam boxes. They look like the houses you see driving down the streets of your neighborhood, from very cold climates to hot and dry climates and some in between. Okay. The numbers here show for each of these the kind of trade-offs you can make. In some cases, the better framing saves you money because you're using less wood. You don't have 2x4s on 16-inch centers. You've got 2x6s on 24-inch centers, and there's less lumber involved. Okay, you will pay more for windows. Those numbers are all pluses. You save some money on downsized air conditioners. Okay, and when you get all done with this, your bottom line here, in some cases, the builder is not paying as much money to build you an energy-efficient house. In some cases, in the one case in California, it was up as much as $2,000, although Phoenix, Tucson, a similar climate, was only up $100. Annual savings are, say, $200 to $400. You can do the math on the payback periods. In some cases, they're negative, and in some cases, they're just not very long. So this is a very cost-effective way to go. Now, whole house energy use also has appliances. So we not only have the kind of things the builder does, but choices that you make about what to go in them. Refrigerators are a big success story from the National Appliance Energy Standards. They've come down over the last 30 years a factor of 4 in energy consumption. You cannot buy a bad refrigerator today. On the other hand, looking ahead, most of the potential energy savings from fridges has already been realized. It's possible to go down another half from that, but the easy gains have been made. Lighting, most of us have some number of incandescent lights still in our house. Compact fluorescence here and here. A lot of these are choices for commercial buildings, metal halide lamps, high-pressure sodium. This is the stuff you see on streets and parking lots and prisons where people don't care about color rendition. We buy them for their efficiency, not their aesthetics. Some people say that with more research in solid-state lighting, these kind of things that you use in camping and traffic lights, can get us up to about 170 lumens a watt, which would be, say, twice the best fluorescent, close to twice the best fluorescent lights now. That's one area of that's a good source of target for research. Just a couple more here. Washing machines, kind of prosaic federal standards. This is kilowatt hours per cycle, so at 10 cents, it's about 25 cents to run a load of wash. Federal standards in 2004, Energy Star labeling, best available in 2006, about less than half of the federal standard. 2007, the standards get somewhat better, but best available today will still beat sort of the minimum standard another year. Air conditioners, similar sort of success stories. U.S. average, down, down, down. Best available now in 2006, about 40%. Of the U.S. average of about 30 years ago. The last one is a ground source heat pump where we're essentially taking advantage of the thermal storage in the earth. And then we're down to just a little more than a quarter the energy that people used for air conditioning a generation ago. Okay. Now, how about zero energy houses? This is about 10 years old. It's in central Florida. Is it cost effective? No. The payback period, even with some better choices of construction, was about 28 years with the PV. But the interesting story here is that better overhangs on the window, better walls, better windows, and you've taken out about 3/4 of the energy of a kind of a standard built neighboring house. The PV knocks out another 20% and you're left with something like 10%. That's coming off the grid. So even if we don't worry about the PV, that's 3/4, and that's even more than say the half. So if you're willing to pay more, then you can go to 50% and beyond. Low end of the market. This is a house, Habitat for Humanity house, a group of 5 in central Tennessee that one of our national labs has worked on. They're small, about 1,100 square feet. They have a mix of very advanced technologies, wall panels that really are about 6 inches of rigid foam insulation with sheathing on either side, mechanical ventilation, waste heat scavenging for the hot water. Where does that come from? Well, your fridge is putting out heat in your kitchen, and if you pipe that in your hot water heater, then less air conditioning and less hot water heat. About $2 a day to run one of these houses, a third of which was heating and cooling. Much of the remaining 2/3 was Christmas lights, as it turns out, for a long season. These aren't particularly cost-effective yet, in large part because of the PV, but there's room for improvement. Now, one of the problems in this is that people don't have sort of a rational basis for making efficiency investments. Where do I stop investing in efficiency and then go to PV, for instance, or other forms of on-site generation if I'm serious about going to carbon neutral in coming years? It is possible now to do that with simulation programs, and the way this typically comes out is like so. Base case, you may be spending $1,200 a year for utilities. As you start to invest in efficiency, you can drive your annual costs down. Utilities come down a lot. You're amortizing some of your efficiency, all of your efficiency investment, and putting that onto your mortgage. So here's your 30% or so that is at little or no increase in first cost. You can push that out with less effective measures, more insulation, maybe even solar hot water, and get to a point where you're still saving on a life cycle basis. Okay, but at that point, your last leap is the PV, and that's expensive. So a lot of the game now is going from here to here, and how does one do that at costs that are affordable? Simulations can be run en masse and automatically to identify the best set of features. So, for instance, you could spend $1,300 a year or $800 a year and get the same energy savings, and that's a matter of making careful choices about windows, walls, appliances, lights. And this kind of software tool, which is, well, one of my arguments at the end will be to make these available more ubiquitously. You can do this on a climate-specific basis and make appropriate choices. We've probably talked enough about this, and the PV is still the expensive part of this, but something more to say about that now. It's a wee bit blurry, okay? So I showed you the slide of all the buildings on the roof at MIT. These are full-size houses. There are about 10 of them. They were part of a solar decathlon. These are college students demonstrating 1,000 square foot, completely passive houses. On our National Mall in September of 2005. The next round will be September 2007. Here's the Canadian entry, okay? So it has some PV on the roof, and some of you heard Nate Lewis earlier today talk about this, but interestingly, they take the waste heat off the backside of that. You know, you have a lot of sun shining on your walls, and most of the time we think we don't want it, okay? We want to keep it out if we're in a hot climate. PV is only converting 12, 15% of that into electricity. What happens to the rest? The PV doesn't want it. It runs best when it's cooler, okay? So the rest you hope to get rid of somehow before it gets into your building. Well, the Canadians at Concordia said, why don't we just duck that somehow? And we can use it. We can use it for hot water through a heat exchanger. We can use it to heat it in the Canadian winter. They put this on the mall, but then they dragged it back to Canada, and they run it year-round in Montreal. And they found that you could boost the effective efficiency of all of this stuff from about 8%, including the batteries and the inverters and all of the stuff that you've probably heard about, to about 35%. Okay? That makes a huge difference. Okay? So the economics I've showed you, that crossover point, now changes because you can get more energy out of these panels than you could before. Okay, commercial building, the words here aren't so interesting. Let me just get into some of these. The issue with commercial buildings is that there's been a lot less effort to sort of look at it as a systematic basis. Most commercial buildings are built just to meet code and not a lick better. The numbers that do better than that, we could count on the fingers of our hands probably in the first few rows. We're talking about hundreds, not tens of thousands. You meet code, you go on, okay? I'm going to show you a few examples of buildings that do better than that to some extent for inspiration. This is a generation old, early 80s. It's a state office building in Boston, houses the State Department of Transportation. That's Boston Common in the background. It has a big atrium, and it borders some historic buildings and so on. Okay, this isn't an ME sort of quiz, but this is the plumbing system for the building. And if you squinted at that and you were really into this, you could play a little game and say, what's not there? These things are the air conditioners. These are the cooling towers on the top. These are the fans in here. What is not there is a boiler. There is no boiler in this building. There is no external source of heat other than a little bit of steam for entranceways and so on. What does it have? It doesn't have a whole lot of stone like a European cathedral that can stay cool on a hot day. Okay? What it does have is 750,000 gallons of water sitting in the basement in three tanks. So in our little examples, and even in the bigger things that on the mall, we fill up Fiji water bottles and say, there is our thermal storage. This has three swimming pools in the basement. Okay? All the heat from the building core, from lights, from equipment, goes into those tanks in the day. The core needs cooling year-round. There's no place for the heat to go. And it's used for the perimeter. The perimeter often needs heat in the morning because it's cool. It may overheat some in the day, and then it'll need some heat at night. So in a typical building, you just blow this out during the day or even run air conditioners, and you heat this. In a typical building, you heat this in the morning, and you cool it in the afternoon. That's pretty wasteful. Okay? This building solves that by using the tanks. Is it a low-energy building? Well, the total is about 60% of the U.S. current average. It's 180 rather than 300. That's not bad. 40% of that is lights. Lights is still the big guy to look after. How does that compare? Well, in Boston, it has a few neighbors. There are some state office buildings, very plain vanilla, that are 3 and 4 times as much energy, okay, and well above the twice the national average. It has some other neighbors that are moderately less than the national average, including a couple that are pretty close to what it's doing. They're not as exotic, but the point is still the same. Recover the heat from the core of the building rather than just dumping it overboard and use it to heat the perimeter. Okay, a couple of office buildings in the UK, and I'll just skim over these. This is one that we looked at for about a year. It's a sealed box out in the UK. That's not thermodynamically not such a good thing to do. We measured the airflow. You normally don't get that information. It's not measured as part of the control system. What did we find? It had 4 times as much air blowing through it as it needed. That was a once-through system, okay? That drove up the heating bills in this building a lot, okay? Why 4 times? Well, half of that was because it didn't have as many people. Did the building meter how many people were in it or measure CO2 or something and adjust the air appropriately? No. Okay. And we said, why can't you fix this? Well, they said because the conference rooms are small and they need a lot of air when they're full. And further, the heat recovery system that was supposed to scrub some of the heat out of that building was broken, which was partly why we were interested in. So we measured CO2. And the outside's about this, and the limit's about 1,000, and you can see that most of the time, even in the crowded conference rooms, it didn't get up to the limit. So if you just say, I will make some decisions about this at design time and not compensate for how many people are using the building, you tend to over-condition it. This is the building, a little more than the U.S. average in kilowatt hours per square meter per year. If you simply fix the airflow and this should have been the reduced airflow, keep the and no heat recovery. If we fix both of them, we lop about a quarter off. Okay, so then we're getting something a little more reasonable. There's a lot of examples of buildings in the U.S. where you can save 20-30% just by paying attention to housekeeping. It's no different from our houses. Here's a neighbor just north of London, a little more prosaic, but same sort of layout, 3 floors. No air conditioning in this building and the windows open. These are stacks at the top for venting it. Very open. Nothing fancy about the windows. People prop them open with books. No actuators. Lots of exposed concrete. They don't use exposed water bottles to keep them from overheating. They've got the ceilings. And they've got big doors and windows they can open, much as we can here in Aspen. In July of 2003, the outside temperature going from about 15, with about 60 to 75 Fahrenheit. The inside temperature very comfortable, 68 to 75, 74. The UK heat wave in August, the outside temperatures went up above 100 F. Did it get warm in this building? Yeah, it did. It went up as high as 30, that's about 85. People turned on fans. But they didn't do a particularly good job of cooling it at night. And even in the heat of the English summer that year, the outside temperatures were always below 68. There was opportunity to cool it at night. They just weren't taking advantage of. Even as it operated, only about 30% of people said it was too hot. In that one period, 70% of people were okay with it. Just kind of change the names for consistency. That building, problems with heat the first year, but total is about 200 or so. So it's down about 30% relative to the U.S. average and a little more than that, maybe a third relative to that other building. Okay. This is a building going up in San Francisco. It's a federal office building. The bottom 5 floors are bomb-proof, sealed boxes and so on because they have to be. The top floors are naturally ventilated. San Francisco is a cream puff climate, but it still isn't done very much. In section, you've got conference rooms there that will be air-conditioned, but the open office plans are not, and that comes from paying a lot of attention to the windows, pieces that the users can use, control pieces that are mechanically controlled. And simulations have showed that even in a heat wave, a sort of historic heat wave, there would only be 12 to 13 hours inside above 78 F. Now, before you put up something like this, you want to know it's going to work. There are no chillers here. There is no backup, okay? And that was done. A couple of other buildings, one in New York City that's gotten some amount of attention, Simulation, not actual, down a third. An EPA office building simulation, not measured, down two-thirds. One in Annapolis, Maryland, large cooling loads typically, down 60% from the U.S. average, and that's measured. So there's plenty of room to do better. Anyone been to Zion National Park the last couple of years? You've been to the Visitor Center?
Yes.
It's a wonderful building, isn't it? This uses the same technology that Iranians have been using for millennia, the wind catchers. You put a porous media in there, you soak it with water, the air comes in, it's cool, it falls. You stand in front of these big vents inside and you have this gentle, cool breeze that comes out, and it can be 100 F outside, and it, those of you who've been there, it is very, very nice inside. This is a courthouse in California. Lots of numbers here, but just pay attention to the red. This is the building as operated, and based on some short-term measurements that some of us did, about 15% improvement by doing what in an existing building? Just ventilating it at night, just running the fans at night. It's cool enough at LA many nights, and this was based on choosing those cool nights a little carefully. Okay, that I can skip. Okay, just a couple minutes on stuff abroad, and then I'll turn it over to Alexis. Outside the Fourth Ring Road in Beijing, modern residential buildings look like this. I'll editorialize and say I think they're awful. There is no sense of direction, which way is south. There's no shading. There's no community. There's nothing but a concrete box. Shenzhen, a little more landscaping, but the commercial and residential buildings look similar. And if you think you can't do better, then look at what Ken Yang is doing in Kuala Lumpur for IBM and other clients. That's at least moderately climate sensitive in terms of exposure and porosity at times of day when you can take advantage of that. Housing project we worked on, this is a development outside of Beijing. Wind-driven cooling doesn't work because big buildings block it. We came up with something where you could sort of ventilate it with sort of exhaust fans through a common stack. And what did we find? Well, the red here is outside temperatures on a design day in Beijing, which is very similar to Chicago. So it goes up to the low 90s during the day. And the blue is inside. This is sort of a typical plain vanilla. So if you just build yourself an apartment house in Beijing and move in, it goes up to about 35. And, of course, you're going to buy air conditioning. That's 95 Fahrenheit. Okay. If you're careful about your windows, about shading your walls, if you're careful about appliances and ventilate at night, depending on how careful you are about your appliances, you end up somewhere down here. And that, whoops, sorry, let me go back up one. That gets you down in the upper 70s Fahrenheit, and then maybe you don't need air conditioning. Yeah, question?
Could you comment at all about when you talk about the walls, are you assuming just normal drywall?
Oh, in this kind of building? Yeah, well, in this one, the base case had more or less an inch of rigid foam equivalent in China, but it's mainly just masonry material and then drywall on the inside. And the change would be to have modestly more insulation and then some attempt to get to have a coating that would reduce the absorptivity on the outside or shade it with vegetation. Oh, the windows of double pane low E in the more advanced one. Okay, nothing particularly fancy. But the problem here is that if you buy an apartment in Beijing, you don't get this choice because the building's already up. The walls are already done. The windows are already spec'd for you. So you choose your appliances and you choose your air conditioner, and there's no system level thinking about this. Here's one in Shanghai, a little better ventilation. It's pretty open there, but more or less the same problems. Okay, just a couple minutes about India. This is rural India. We tend to talk about mega cities. This is where two-thirds of Indians live. Very little in the way of resources or comfort. And the big issue here is cooking. That's dung on the walls that's dried. People cook on it in their stoves. The smudge there in the black ceiling indicates the soot. The women breathe that, and it's a big health problem. There's a little bit of biogas that can be digested, not a whole lot. Architecture can help with that some. Sort of diversion of some of our liquid or gaseous fuels to people like this would also help. We've done some work on trying to improve rural architecture. Pakistan, 150 million people, very little energy use. This is the northern part of Pakistan, earthquake country. Buildings like so, school like so. School can't be used 4 to 6 weeks in the winter. Why? Because kids' fingers don't work too well when it's freezing inside. There's no heat. There's no wood to provide heat. There's no insulation in the wall. One thing we were doing was looking at using wheat chaff and pressing it with a little bit of a binder, a glue, and making something they could use for insulation. Russia, this is just sort of for orientation, the typical Khrushchev-y five-story apartment building in post-World War II Russia. The standards there said if you build your house out of brick, Three Little Pigs style, the insulation you have to have is precisely the insulation of the brick, which means nothing added, and brick's not a very good insulator. The standards were changed as part of some work that that Rob Sokolow and others of us got involved in to say, no, you can't use brick. You need to use something better. Those same sort of decisions on codes need to be faced in China and to some extent in developing countries. Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe, here's a large office building, relatively low cost. There is no air conditioning in this building. It has heavy mass, it has shading, it has natural ventilation inside through the central core. Why is there no air conditioning? Not because they're environmentally virtuous, because they didn't want to pay for it and maintain it. You don't call up the train repairman and he comes the next day or the same afternoon. Okay. UK and elsewhere, buildings by Alan Short, an architect. This is a brewery in Malta. It gets hot in the Mediterranean. There is no mechanical cooling there. It gets cold at night, cool at night. They use that to keep the brewing vats about 20 degrees C. This is a theater, and this is a library. These funny things on the top are big ventilation stacks. There is not a lick of air conditioning in these buildings. And this is not environmental virtue either. These people want to sell tickets or they want their library to be used. It's something where they could work out the engineering with some confidence and do it. This is an engineering school in the Midlands. Auditoria, classrooms, not a lick of air conditioning in there. Okay. Why hasn't our energy use been going down given all these improvements? Well, some of it is lifestyle. The square feet per person that we have in this country have tripled since baby boomers started having families. Now, that's leveling off some, which is good. You know, McMansions only go so far. But you compensated that with some of our appliance gains that those are sunk gains at this point. Okay. There's a big potential for just market take-up in what we're not already doing. Okay. Compact fluorescent sales, only 10%, one of every 10 light bulbs in the Northwest, the sort of eco-region, are CFLs. Up 10%, only 11% of market during the early 2000s energy crisis. Electrician in my house recently installed one, came to put a fixture in the basement and put in a CFL, so maybe there's hope. I didn't even ask him. And he said, high-efficiency appliances, we are typically buying clothes dryers and air conditioners that are well below the best available. Rob, are you going to talk about stabilization triangles?
It's in your talk, keep going.
Okay. There are various ways of looking at climate change, some a little more gloom and doom, some a little more optimistic. I buy into the Pakala and Sokolow more optimistic. We can do a lot of little things together in the next 50 years, buy ourselves some time, stabilize CO2 at twice pre-industrial. Conservation is a piece of this, so everything I've been giving you is one chunk here. And we can fill up that whole wedge with buildings by knocking out a quarter, and I hope I've given you some hope for some reason for hope that in buildings we can do this. A laundry list here, which I'll skip over, but the point here again is a little more integrated thinking, I think, in not just PV, but PV with heat recovery, not just better appliances, but better building design, and we can kind of get to where we at least in part, to where we want to go. Okay, deep breath. I'll switch over now. It's sort of the usual academic disease of trying to put too much in, but we start a little late, so we're not at the halfway point. Alexis will give you a little more of the in practice working with clients, and we're almost off here, so we can change this over. At both the individual building and community level to bring efficiency into practice.
Okay. Let's see if this works. Real quick. How about that? Well, Les, you did a fantastic job. I have to say this was very impressive and a tough act to follow, just because I think he did such a great job of laying out what is possible, showing what's been done and how much we've improved. We seem to forget, you know, how much our efficiency has improved over the years, and really, you know, what's possible in the future as well. I want to take a little step back, actually, because although the title of this session was about energy efficiency, I want to ask us whether this is really the right question. And I think when Les showed you the slides of Pakistan and China and actually some of the people who don't have any of the advantages that we have, it's really more clear what the right question is. To me, the right question is, how do we provide what we want? And what do we want? Well, we want comfort, we want convenience, we want health and productivity, and we want to do all that in the long term without compromising our environment or soiling our nest or using up more than we have. So ultimately, you know, in listening to Les's presentation, underlying all of it, he showed you what was possible in terms of carbon neutral or 100%, you know, zero net energy buildings. Ultimately, using current solar income is the answer in the future. So I just want to go through some more examples of what's possible and then also whether it's affordable. And I think Les has also addressed a lot of that as well. As Amory likes to say, we know it's possible because it exists. So it is possible to have these houses and buildings that use only current solar income, but we have to take a slight paradigm shift. And I like this joke because, in fact, we have to all show up at the office the next day and realize that the question that we're asking is a different question. In fact, just to remind us of what's possible, each day more energy falls onto the Earth than we could all consume in 27 years. And this energy can be used as solar energy, and Les didn't get too much into wind power or micro hydro or other forms, solar thermal, tidal, all kinds of different ways of providing energy. But there are lots of examples. This building is producing more energy than it uses. And I suppose, you know, if you're looking at the cost effectiveness of it, yes, those solar panels were very expensive. But it's producing 2.5 times its own consumption, and I think it's an example of something that we can look toward as a goal. Natural ventilation. There's a lot of buildings, as Les showed, in Europe that are using natural ventilation in many of the climates that are not Houston's climate or Florida's climate. But again, here's a building that's using methane cogeneration. It was on the brownfield site, a former coal mine, and producing more energy than it uses. This is a building in the U.S., the Oberlin Adam J. Lewis Center for Environmental Studies, which was also designed right here in the U.S. to produce more energy than it uses. I'm not sure if they've gotten quite to that point yet with their PV installation, but that's the goal. And again, using a lot of, and here's the key that I think you got from Les's presentation as well, using a lot of demand reduction strategies first. Passive solar, good insulation, using water systems appropriately so you're not wasting other resources as well. And it has this thing called a living machine, which is treating its sewage in a greenhouse using plants and a series of ecosystems where the sewage flows through. Oh, Les showed you this building, so I won't dwell on it too much, but I love the fact that this is an engineering school with no engineered, well, it's well-engineered to be completely passive, but it has no air conditioners, and they're teaching engineers, mechanical engineers, about these systems in a school that's passively daylit, passively air-conditioned through natural ventilation and other systems, as he described. And the only thing that you didn't mention about Eastgate, which I'm going to show this really briefly, is how did Mick Pierce get the idea that he could have a building that in Zimbabwe without air conditioning, a commercial building that's, you know, has to be comfortable for people. Well, he looked around, and it turns out that these little critters, we don't think of as particularly smart, but they live in houses that are 30 feet tall, they're hard as concrete, and they're made completely out of termite saliva and wood fibers and dirt. And they're completely passively cooled. They have to maintain an exact 87 degree Fahrenheit temperature inside in order for the termites to cultivate the fungus, which is their only food. It has to stay constant, no matter if the temperature outside is 110 or hotter. And they do it. They do it by circulating air. Basically, the top is heated, and that makes the air exhaust through the stack effect, and they're circulating it down into these tunnels that they dig through the ground table water. So just to throw it out there, let's benchmark not against what can be 30% or 50% more efficient, but against perfection. This is the California Academy of Sciences building, and it is showing you how the little blue bar there is how it's doing against a standard building. It's a fraction of the energy use, but we can actually do better with what's called a living building, and that would be something maybe more akin to the one I just showed, the Eastgate building, or maybe something like this that's even using a material that is very sustainable and sequesters a lot of carbon as it grows. Bamboo is not a wood, it's actually a grass, and it's the fastest growing grass that exists. And as you can see, it sequesters 40 times more carbon per square meter than trees. Grasses do this. Our prairie grasses in the Midwest do this. And so our buildings can, if we're trying to get climate neutral buildings, can also look at their materials as well as their energy consumption. Just to show a few communities, this is a very old, really, 20, 30 years old community, but it was doing something even that long ago that it's achieving on a larger scale some of the ideas about houses that Les showed you in more modern buildings, really designed these little houses that are passively oriented, and so they're getting solar energy. But the layout of the community itself was well designed. The streets were narrower. They were then shaded with trees. That cools everything down. It also provided not a standard sewage treatment, storm sewer system, but these swales just to naturally fill up and divert the water away. And even people's yards would absorb some of that water. It would go away within 6 days, so no mosquitoes would grow. The city said, well, you can't do this. This is not conventional, and you're going to have to take out a performance bond so that when the system fails, you will have the money in place to put in a conventional system. First 100-year flood that came along, this was the only system in Davis, the only subdivision that didn't flood. It actually performed as it was supposed to. This saves $800 a lot, and they reinvested that money in things like a park and a community center and an almond orchard and all sorts of other wonderful things. A little more recently, in 2000, the Noonington Sydney Olympic Village converted into a community. It was a brownfield site. And while we're talking about communities, why not convert our existing plots of land that already have infrastructure, that have transportation, that are close to things that we want to be close to, into something usable? Restored this stream that was a culverted thing into a nice stream, and 70% open space. Doing all of this, it also has this grid-connected PV system, which the homeowners didn't have to buy. The utility actually installed it, but they get the benefit of the PV in their community. And look at this. The home prices have risen because it's such a desirable place to live for many reasons. Even more recently, the Bedsead community, Beddington Zero Energy Development in London, is an example of really taking that a step further and trying to reduce the ecological footprint of the entire community. it is, you know, if you read about this in the news, it's experiencing some difficulties with some of the systems, but really the point is what they're trying to achieve is very valid. It's an excellent design, again, using, I'm not going to dwell on this, but passive solar and a lot of different systems to, first of all, reduce the energy demand. And then you can see there's a lot of systems for waste disposal, for electricity, biofuels, photovoltaics, really a very comprehensive integrated system. And I just want to skip to this slide because it shows you that if you were living in BedZed with, and there's two ideas of a type of lifestyle, the conventional lifestyle and the in the dark green, the ideal lifestyle, you could actually consume, this is the global available overall eco footprint, what's available basically with our Earth, 1.9, I'm not sure exactly what the units are, but you could actually be ecologically neutral with your lifestyle choice, living in this development, which is already much lower than the typical UK lifestyle.
Well,
yeah, it is hard to read. That means that instead of driving your car everywhere, maybe you take public transportation or ride your bike. You probably are more conservative with your water use, with your food choices, all of those types of things. But it's also starting with a very good housing approach that reduces your energy demand considerably already. But, you know, it's recycling, it's no car, it's, you know, it's two yearly holidays by plane rather than, you know, whatever, five or six or whatever. So it is possible. I'm actually going to skip through this kind of this one because I think Les already sort of showed this whole idea. This is our building. If you have a chance to take a tour of our building, go for it. It's interesting to see that with 20-year-old technology, this building really doesn't use much energy. It's pretty neutral, even in the winter, because of all this passive solar and all the thermal mass that it's collecting it. And we do have a lot of solar cells. And this is another example of showing you how these incremental costs that you add on to make your building more efficient can be compensated by how much you save in other systems. So we added cost with the windows, the daylighting, and the insulation, but reduced cost considerably with the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system, and so the overall cost was actually less expensive on a commercial building. And it turns out that energy efficiency is actually a very low-risk investment strategy. I mean, if you look at the stock market, where can you get, you know, 25% return on investment? It's not that easy in any investment to do that well. It's a very secure and known return. If you do these things, you will reduce your energy use. So financially, it's a good idea. There's efficiency. And I just want to finish then with this example of a building that if we're talking about, so we know it's possible, and we're talking about is it a good investment or is it financially feasible, I want to finish with a bank. Because a bank, and this is no exception, had to be financially feasible in the building of their new building. This is the ING Bank in Amsterdam, and the task of this building was to achieve a building that was good for employees, that was low energy use, that was a wonderful place to work, had natural light and plants and things like that. Well, they did this in a wonderful environment. You can see it, the parking is all underground, and it has this garden on the roof. It has daylight coming in each of these towers, coming all the way down, a couple stories down, and it's harvesting its rainwater. It's using gas absorption chillers instead of conventional air conditioners. All of these things, including operable windows, which is pretty unusual in a bank. And what's the final result? Well, 90% energy savings over both the prior building that they were in and also compared to the building across the street, which was built at the same time. 90% energy savings. That's a $2.9 million annual return on their investment, and so it only was a three-month payback ultimately. Again, a bank is very fiscally responsible, and it was very successful. But the most important point of all of this is their absenteeism dropped. People were more productive. And even though they found that the building didn't save quite as much energy as they expected because people wouldn't go home at night. They actually stayed there longer. They held parties there, weddings and things like that, so it used a little bit more energy. The fact that their absenteeism dropped, people were happier, more productive. Again, this gets back to my first point, is that the bottom line is that we have comfortable, healthy buildings, buildings that are wonderful for people to inhabit, and bottom line, energy savings as well. So thanks. That's all I have to say, and I think we've saved some time.
Oh, you've done great.
For 20 minutes.
We've got 20. Yeah, we have 25 minutes. We have lots of time.
Fabulous.
In the back.
I've been doing a lot of sustainable rebuilding in developing countries, and it's very easy to do this sort of work in developing nations. It's also quite easy to do this on buildings that are very costly and have a lot of energy costs. Mm-hmm. Currently, what we're working on is rebuilding down on the Gulf Coast for low-income families. Mm. And we have had a lot of pushback from FEMA and some other people about introducing sustainable technologies because of how costly they are. Mm-hmm. Is there, and it's really hard to find, is there anywhere that really has product-related products that are not only sustainable but cost-effective? And then the other killer app, if any of you want to make a lot of money, the other killer app is the mold-resistant insular panels, so that also have some sustainable quality. So is there any list? Because I've been working all over the country for...
I'll just say one thing really quickly. I have we're working with a client who is doing something that's already done quite a bit in Europe, but building modular, he hasn't started up yet, but building modular housing energy efficiently.
I would say modular housing is a huge disaster on the Gulf Coast.
Well, but I mean, it could actually, if built well, and not modular housing the way you're thinking of it. I mean, he's trying to do normal looking houses just in pieces and putting them together
right.
into any. It's not a.
Convince U.S. manufacturing firms to do energy-efficient housing for low-income families using modular. The other thing is that the funds that are going down on the Gulf Coast then go
right.
to large corporations and not families that need it. So you need to have a building envelope that involves local construction companies rather than one multinational that's going to take all the federal funding. So that's the challenge.
Well, that is a challenge. You would ideally have the factory that you're building your pieces of your houses in right there in the area where you wanted to build them. I'm just saying that, if we're thinking about lower cost, then if you can build pieces, and they do this in Europe because they don't have a lot of labor. So they build sections, and then they just put them in with cranes. Reduces the cost a lot.
Another answer to the question, the information needed to, say, tech on a problem that you have is not as widespread as it should be, both products and then how to do the kind of the integrated design that you've seen from the examples. But one place I would go in your position would be go to DOE's website for the Building America mm-hmm. project. There were six very good consulting engineering firms who led those teams. One in my area, Building Science Corporation, has done a lot of work on moisture transport through envelopes. And I think you could go to any one of those people, get links through DOE's website, and that would be a decent place to start.
And
a little bit of consulting money someplace, I think, would go a long way toward getting you where you would need to go.
And the books that Building Science Corporation puts out,
right.
The Energy Resource Guide.
Yeah, there's a lot of that's on, right. A lot of that's on the web for free. There's sort of these climate specific. Here's how you can do a house that will save 30, 40, 50%. Some you buy, some are there. Complete specs, wall specs, insulation, air tightness, mold prevention. So yeah, that's a good point, and that that would be a good source of information. Yes, sir.
Is there progress being made? I guess I've been through personally a number of. US Green Building Council LEED certification for commercial buildings. Do you see progress being made on the residential front that would sort of parallel sort of these commercial things? Is there a metric out there that's...
Well,
they are working on LEED residential.
Yeah, they are working on LEED residential. I would... I think there's been more progress on the residential side than the commercial side. I don't want to downplay LEED. It has encouraged commercial customers to think about efficiency and not just marble lobbies, and that's to the good. And as you know, it's more on the commercial side than the residential side. But the number of LEED certified commercial buildings is still just a few hundred, and it is not that many. There are 30,000 Building America houses, and as Alexis pointed out, specs for how to do those. In any climate in this this country, so I mean, the certification equivalent would be Energy Star rather than LEED, and builders do take advantage of that. They get some, there's some cachet in selling an Energy Star certified house.
And maybe the only difference is that LEED is looking at a lot of different issues besides energy, and the Energy Star and the Building America programs are certifying thousands and thousands of houses. But they're only looking at energy because it's very easy to measure, and it's much harder to address those other issues. But I agree. There are also so many local programs. As you know, right here in Aspen, Bill. I mean, you've got the Aspen Green Points program. Austin has a program. Portland has a program. So there's lots of places where residential programs are just as good as LEED.
Yeah, I'm familiar with also working with their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
That all of us look at it, and you can see a lot of opportunity for improving on those standards. But in working with clients and giving them some sort of standard to be judged by, just looking for something on the residential side that would be akin to LEED. I guess it's
Energy Star. I think would be the
the
two-word answer.
Well, the dumbed-down LEED for home is the NEH for green. It was just published at the International Roofer Show in January.
Sorry, can you say that again?
The dumbed-down version of LEED for home. LEED is commercial, LEED for home is the draft for residential. It's pretty tough to meet, and it's kind of complicated, but it's the real deal. So NAHB, to compete with it, came up with NAHB green guidelines. It's kind of dumbed down is the way the environmental community looks at it, but it's still very good. And it was just published in January by at the International Builder Show. It's available on their website. And it does, it's getting, it's another people are familiar with it, because it's volume, it's big, it's downloadable from NHP. It's pretty prosaic, but it's going to be adopted by the major builders who are creating most of the damage, imposing the tolls and their hordes, who do actually want to crawl up the food chain. They do want to crawl up and become good guy, because it's commercially correct more than anything else. So they're going to be using NHP green guidance. And those are fairly easy to meet, actually, to understand.
The major focus is
I'd say so. It's probably operating costs, and there's a kind of a total life cycle notion built into it. It's the easiest thing to measure is energy, so but it does get into water consumption, and all the LEED issues are covered. The other reason it's easier to meet NAHB green is because LEED penalizes size, and as single family homes become gigantic, it's almost impossible for a large house to meet LEED. But it's easy for an HB greenhouse, green guidelines. It's not an endorsement of either of those things. It exists out there.
Sure. Yeah. So you just find it
out
there.
On NHB.org.
NAHB, National Association of Home Builders.
NAHB.
What? HG, National Association of Home Builders.
So, yeah. So what are other questions? If not, I'll ask one of the one in the back.
I want to thank you both for your talks. My name is Rick Peavy. And Alexis, I want to thank you too for pointing out that we need to look at construction materials, not just the outlating energy involved. And I know, for example, there are houses in Aspen that have their 10,000 and 15,000 square foot pitched roofs, clad in copper from Chile, presumably. And we need to look at how to reduce energy inputs in construction and that kind of stuff. I don't but want to suggest that people with money can't build large houses, but we need to have alternatives for excessive energy inputs into the construction and the materials. And I want to back you up, Les, with my own experience in building an energy efficient house and old snow mass, my carbon emissions are less than 4 pounds per square foot per year, and the US average is probably closer to 13 or 14 pounds a year. But my question is, should we be focusing really, when we're looking at carbon neutral homes, really on making on-site carbon neutral houses, as opposed to going to some economic optimum in order to expedite and finance so-called wedges, by going to that kind of optimum level of on-site efficiency and then investing through energy efficient mortgages or portfolios or carbon trading, whereby we help invest in efficiency in other customers' homes and commercial buildings. Is there such a system being set up?
Well, it was going to be something, my question to the group. First off, Rick, a number of my slides had PV in it, but I hope I put some emphasis on the kind of the cost-effective breakpoints that you get before that last big gulp. And it is going to what is now cost-effective on a first-cost basis and certainly what's cost-effective on a life-cycle basis that would, in the context of carbon stabilization, buy us some time in terms of contributing to the conservation wedge that is one of the of Rob's handful of strategies. So I personally don't advocate. I would agree with you that going to something that today is not cost effective is maybe is not economically warranted and probably is not necessary in terms of buying us some time. Now the PV prices have come down. The wind energy issues. There are other ways of getting to carbon neutral, and it doesn't have to be at, as you point out, Rick, at the individual building level. My last slide had one thing up that was a little bit fanciful, but it was emissions trading even at, you know, even within a neighborhood or at a building level. If somebody's doing better than another, then maybe one could buy off one's lifestyle against someone who has a smaller house, for instance. There are also opportunities at a community level. We can optimize at different at different levels. A commercial building's waste heat is the residential building's needed heat. So combined commercial residential urban buildings, one can do better than at anything I showed for where you're kind of optimizing at a smaller level. That's not suboptimal. And if the price of PV comes down by a factor of 3 or 4 in 20 years, then maybe it's a different, a different story. But I agree that I think that one could make investments to get at better returns elsewhere.
Buy more efficiency and savings.
Exactly, and buy it elsewhere rather than going that last big step that right now is not cost effective. What do people think about incentives? If the stabilization wedge for efficiency in one of Rob's papers has the, I guess, the two word comment, weak incentives, was that it for the buildings area for conservation? We all make decisions and about what we invest in conservation, and to what extent do people think it's this lack of information? And to what extent are there weak incentives, mainly that the price of energy still isn't high enough to make us take notice?
Well,
Do we need a carbon tax? Yeah.
I think it's very complicated. And if you talk to those people who are in the real estate world, the amount of savings is such a small number that the bother of your office help, lawyers, everything you have to go through, it doesn't make sense. I think someone has to come up with a simplified package of how to, here it is, it's blessed, just do it, here's, you know, the Rocky Mountain Institute could provide that kind of from A to Z. It would be much more effective than people trying to find on their own how to do it.
Well, the Building America packages that, Alexis and I both mentioned do just that, and they are publicly available now. And I think the issue there is that builders need to, I mean, it is builders more than customers who need to buy into that. But some of the large builders, Pulte and others, have built houses using those, and I think it's still kind of a market diffusion issue in given the number of builders involved, but those packages exist.
It's very interesting. And most people here would drive large SUVs. They're inefficient, but they do it. But if you have a business, you have, say, you have to do deliveries, and you have 30 delivery vehicles, and they go and get a very energy efficient vehicle, and it may not be as comfortable as a big one, because it's your business, and this is what you do to maximize profits. We have the same kind of disconnect here. More likely a commercial apartment builder would be more interested than an individual building one house.
Well, of course, that depends on who's paying the energy bills, too, and that's kind of another disconnect. But that's true. That's true. A Walmart is very interested in efficiency. Yeah?
The gentleman in the back.
Oh, okay, in the back.
Well, I was going to ask another question, but a further answer to your question is that it is, to put it in economics terms, it's an inefficient market. Market efficiency is mostly a function of information, and the information on the part of those buyers isn't there. There's been a lot of progress in terms of energy ratings and so forth, so that people can factor in the future costs of usage. That's improved a lot, but by and large, it's still mostly missing, particularly from a housing perspective.
Yeah, I agree with that, and one of my hopes for the future is something where you can get on the web and put in 12 months of energy bills and a basic description of your house, and you get some suggestions. And.
The question I wanted to ask was with respect to the improved absenteeism from that building. Do you know what that was based on? Was it fewer pathogens in the air because of more air turnover, or people just liking being there more?
It's very hard to determine exactly, you know, scientifically what that is, because you'd have to do a double-blind study, and how do you do that with such a unique building? But we, Rocky Mountain Institute, did a study some years ago looking at improved worker performance, which would be lower absenteeism. We looked at several buildings, and it seems to be a combination of better daylighting, views of nature, better air quality, better ergonomics, better acoustics, all of those things that, you know, it's just not rocket science that would improve your working environment and therefore make you absent less. But I mean, if you look at on the flip side, if you look at sick building syndrome, which is this syndrome that's happening in buildings where you feel headaches and you do feel sick, and it's all these chemicals that are in our environment. I mean, just eliminating that is a significant achievement, and so maybe, you know, that has a large part to do with it too.
Yeah.
You know, just a comment on your thought about, you know, incentives, and you know, there are a lot of wonderful ideas and relative to carbon budgeting and how you might create some sort of economy. In this community, some time ago, we adopted a very efficient method, which is draconian and probably can't be implemented elsewhere. But we started with our own supplements to the building code. We've had an insulation code in this county since 1979, and this is available to every community. This is, again, it's not rocket science. You know, we have prescribed, mandated R values for exterior walls. We have super insulation for roofs. I agree with this gentleman. We've got a long way to go in terms of prescribing materials, but
Let me say one more thing about that, and then get the question in the back. The many building codes, most building codes, and the exceptions are places like Aspen or the state of California as a whole, Title 24, are directly derived from national standards that come from from ASHRAE, the group of professionals who put these things out, and then the federal law mandates that states require standards no worse, codes specify levels, efficiency levels no worse than federal standards, or show why, or fit within this code. One of the problems with that is that the national codes do not optimize across systems. So this ASHRAE code that my colleagues have worked on for a generation has three different groups of people. One does envelope, one does HVAC, and one does lighting. And they each do their own little optimization world, and it is economically rational within that group. They have information. So they will say, we will optimize envelope based on some targeted rate of return, and that gets it out of the ignorance of the homeowner who wants an implicit 40% rate of return before, you know, putting in an extra layer of insulation. But because you don't it is so cumbersome a process and there's no optimization across systems, there is nothing like let's put more in the envelope to save in the equipment, or better lighting saves on you know, better daylighting, which is an envelope thing, saves on electric light. And so there's ample room at the local level to do that, and maybe at the national level that kind of systems level thinking will take hold, but it's going to be a while.
Yeah, we have had some great examples of sort of dynamic modeling across all the for big commercial buildings. Mm-hmm. And I agree it doesn't allow you to take a holistic view of the building.
So the back with the baseball cap, you still okay? And then I got this one in here.
Two things that suggestions, as well as the organization I write for World Changing, which I have a lot of trouble with because it's preaching to the choir. And I think we do a lot of preaching to the choir. And in a way, we can look at building code, and it'll take 20 years to change policy. Mm-hmm. I know that. We've been working building codes for on a national level. Really what we need to do is we need to get suppliers like Home Depot and to really push new materials on a general public level. Now, the other thing is I feel that the environmental materials world has a really bad PR problem. You know, it's almost seen as if, you know, you're a do-gooder, we're trying to, like, drop the whole tree-hugger aspect of people's lives, as if it's like the onus is on you. And in a way, much like Al Gore and his climate crisis, and you can figure out you go to his website, you figure out your almost like moral footprint, you know, it's pretty depressing. But, you know, almost if we had somewhere that you really could plug in your, how to get an energy efficient home, you put in all your statistics and you figure out, okay, for a $5,000 investment, you know, there's nowhere there where the general public can. I think we also need to figure out how to change the general public's mind that it's cost effective for them, because it's only going to happen through volume.
He almost said exactly what I was about to say. I don't think any of this in the end will happen quickly as a matter of legislation or building code changes. It all has to be done in the marketplace. And what I think a lot of this stuff is missing right now is sort of innovative retailers and wholesalers. They're going out there and setting up systems by which people can find this stuff. I think we're at a point culturally, we're almost at a tipping point where people are starting to think about this stuff in that way that you need them to think, which is a combination of it's in their economic self-interest, and there's also something very emotional now that's beginning to take hold, where people want to do the right thing. So I think the opportunities are absolutely there, but people need to step up and set up systems by which you don't have to work so hard to participate in the process of being a responsible citizen. So I think this whole movement needs innovative entrepreneurs, and it needs it desperately. And the PR segment of that is a big hunk of it, as it is in any business.
Yes, in the back.
I just wanted to ask one more time. Are the changes taking place in the world of drywall, plaster, and some of those as it pertains to commercial buildings in terms of things changing in the industry or better insulation or whatever?
I'm not an expert in that area. I think most of what I've seen in commercial buildings in terms of wall systems is pretty much the way it has been. There's been work off and on over the last two generations on, say, phase change materials and wall boards that would soak up energy in periods when it's hot and then release it in periods when it's cold. And I think there's a little more interest in that sort of thing. Moisture absorption and desorption is an issue, but Alexis, you
have or materials like agriboard, which is basically a waste product. It's agricultural waste pressed between oriented strand board without
OSB is a good example.
Glues and adhesives, and that actually can be a structural material for interior or exterior walls. It's non-flammable, and it, so basically it's addressing a lot of those issues with very low embodied energy.
But he had asked about commercial buildings. The Oak Ridge house I showed in the slide did have structural insulated panels, but I see that in residential and not commercial. Rob, you had a comment?
Well, it's taken two different directions from what we've spoken about so far. Just to talk about it. One is trust but verify. That? You did in some of your slides carefully use the words measured or estimated.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't have the time to have a little to explore that little road and say it's a big difference.
Yeah.
And all through this, part of it's confidence building for public. Part of it is generally learning what works, not just what's supposed to work. But all through both residential, commercial demonstrations and mass production systems, there's an important role for a whole class of people, jobs, implement makers, and so on, to learn our way in. And there's a skeptic in this room for the first two presentations might have said, look, you'll be more persuasive if you tell me what didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I was inclined to say that to both of you, because they don't all work. In fact, some of the buildings you talked about, some of us know don't work.
Right.
And we'd like to know more about that story. The stories are actually richer than the story of what was supposed to happen and then full stop. Related to that is the question of how you get people interested in some number that reflects the quality of the actual performance of their home or their community or their university. Princeton, where I work, is going to embark over the next few years in greening itself. One of the first questions is, well, what are you going to measure? What's your system boundary? Does it include commuting? Does it include the students flying in and out from the England? Whether they go home over the years? Or let's say it's just the boundary. How can you easily measure it? Where are there nodal points? If you're interested in communities consumption, it might be a town. You don't have to sum it up over all the houses. There are places where there's a trunk of some sort, in gas or electricity or something else, gas stations. So you've got a whole lot of issues around measurement and scoring and motivating around scoring. What if Aspen, as a community, knew its consumption of something?
It does. Actually, Rick Keaty just did a study of the
here's the number
climate
in the Aspen Times on the top right corner next to the sales price.
I want to respond.
People know, what's missing from the discussion is all the issues, motivation, confidence building, learning.
Yeah, that got shortchanged. So I was careful to give a few examples of measured energy consumption, the 300 kilowatt per square meter per year average for commercial buildings, and several of the ones in there were relative to that. The one from the UK I would take is one that didn't work because of the excessive ventilation and the broken heat recovery system. That was intended to be a low-energy building, and I didn't play that up. It turned out to be a little bit worse than average because of poor design and poor operation. There is not, but Rob makes a good point, there's not a lot of measured data. DOE's database on high-performance buildings, most of it is simulated, few of it is measured. The one building I had the measured data, and one thing I didn't talk about, and well, we're just getting to it now, Rob usefully brings it up, is some sort of benchmarking. Where are we Where is my house relative to a neighbor's house? We have a good sense of what our cars are, the choices we make there. We don't know how our houses stack up against our community average, against the national average. And it's not, conceptually, it's not hard to make those data available.
Some utilities do that.
They do.
Public neighborhood kilowatt-hour consumption. But doesn't that identify customers?
But you don't need that. Just where am I against, you know, my community, or, you know, by any kind of differentiation that you want.
It's 3:45,
so. It is. So there are other sessions at 4. We thank you all for sharing this session with us.